Good morning, everyone. The Mary Griffith Show is underway, and we are going to talk today to representatives from the Academy, a school within a school in the Quincy Public School System, but they have students from outside Quincy as well. The Mary Griffith Show brought to you each and every morning by Refreshment Services Pepsi, Harvest Ridge Coffee. Welcoming back Marcy Wells, the director of the Academy. Good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
So glad to have you here. And someone new, I think, to the show, Erica Corbo, a teacher at the Academy.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. The Academy is for students who are really not functioning well in a regular schoolroom. They're put into this separate little Academy, and there's about 80 students there, and you work a lot on attendance. You work a lot on making up because they haven't kept up with their schoolwork. They're falling behind. You're trying to get them across that graduation goal line, but they have a lot of problems. They have behavioral problems is why they're recommended to the Academy. So you also have to work on some of their anger and rage issues and get them to understand that everybody's got problems. We have to learn to cope with our problems and do that in a loving way. So that's kind of a pretty good synopsis, I think, of what you do every day, right?
I think that it encompasses a variety of areas that we do focus on at the Academy. Yes, Mary,
okay.
we are considered a regional safe school program, which is partly funded by the Regional Office of Education, and then of course a partnership with Quincy Public Schools, and we do serve all of Adams County.
Okay, so students from other districts can come in, but today we're going to talk about Erica Corvo, because you have a specific function there at the Academy, and these students do sometimes learn differently. And so please talk about, you know, what you're doing, because Marcy has said famously that you have to really get to know these children, earn their trust, find out why they don't want to succeed or why they're having so much trouble succeeding. Find the why, find the cause, fix the problem, and move on. And that's part of what you do every day, I'm sure, as a teacher there.
Yeah, it's nice. As a teacher at the Academy, we have two different types of learning situations. So one is online learning, where we're working with an online curriculum, and so I'm really there just to help support them through what they're learning. We've also this year started doing a focused study skills group, which is our class for homeroom, which is focusing on neuroscience. And so that's kind of helping them understand the why behind their feelings, their emotions, and also how to manage those big feelings in a more productive, healthy way. And the great thing is I think we as teachers are really learning from it too. There's lots anyone could use in it.
Well, neuroscience, that's pretty highfalutin. I mean, that takes some advanced intellectual skills to really understand that. And I guess that just goes to show these kids are not dumb.
Absolutely.
They're just not motivated sometimes. So you have to put them into a special academy and get them right with the world and get them where they can graduate. Now, when you talk about the neuroscience of behavior, wow, I mean, that's like a PhD project. So what are some of the things that the children are getting, like a light bulb moment? Oh, because that happened to me when I was 3, or because that happened to me when I was 7, or because that consistently happened to me when I was 13, my brain reacts when this happens now when I'm 17 or whatever.
Well, I think the nice thing, too, is we really started at the basics. Everybody has emotions. Everybody has every single emotion and feeling. And so helping everybody understand it's nothing unusual or wrong. It's just when we have that feeling, how should we respond? Also, when you take this is a me problem and you turn it into, oh, this is just a natural reaction, how do I handle it? I think it makes it less of a source of embarrassment or something if you've had a big feeling. The other thing that's nice about it is now we all have common language in the school because all of the teachers are teaching from the same curriculum. And so if a student needs to regulate, you can say, oh, I feel like you're maybe not using your prefrontal cortex right now because you're overwhelmed. So how about you go take a regulation? Do you want to do that with somebody? Can you do that on your own? What types of things would help you feel calmer? And so it's also helping them have skills they can use outside of the school.
Yeah, I think every once in a while Scott wants to say to me, I think, Mary, you're not using your prefrontal cortex. Would you like to take a moment? But it's interesting because for some people, I can just play devil's advocate here. They're like, well, what snowflakes? I mean, suck it up, buttercup. Life's tough. So it's interesting. You're helping them to understand. What's that movie out where everybody's in emotions? What's the name of that?
Inside Out, probably.
Inside Out, yeah, okay. Well, I haven't seen it, but I don't have kids. But everybody does have these emotions. It's just the way you deal with them. Well, bottling them up is also not a good idea.
Right. And so one thing we've been talking about is, so as a teacher, I've heard lots of times in different subjects, well, when am I ever going to use this? And one thing about neuroscience is we all have brains, and we're always going to have emotional reactions, whether it's a positive reaction or a negative reaction. And so I would argue everybody needs it. When you say just snowflakes need it, no, I think that every single person can benefit from understanding their emotions and why they're experiencing those feelings, what different sensations they experience that cause that reaction. So I think everybody benefits from understanding neuroscience a bit better.
Well, and also anything that happened to you, any trauma you may have had, you may have had a physical trauma to your head, or you may have had trauma that is deeply embedded into your, you know, thought process, your memory core. So all of those things, you know, starting and getting the basics and then delving deeper and deeper to have people understand this is why, you know, mental health is so important, mm-hmm. because everybody is at risk of having some kind of mental illness, whether temporarily or for a long term. And I think that when we understand that, just like, you know, if I break my arm, I'm going to be in a sling for a while, but I'm not going to be in a sling the rest of my life. So the same thing is true with them when you're teaching them. Just because you're having trouble accepting your emotions or dealing with your emotions now, you can learn how to do this. Just like if you practice baseball, you'll get better. If you practice with your neuroscience, you'll get better. So
no, for sure.
Is that helpful for them?
I think so. I also think even myself as an adult, I can, because we're also working on learning how to read your body better in terms of the sensations you're receiving and the reactions that you're having. So for instance, if I am feeling frustrated, I might feel that my palms are getting clammy or that my heart rate's beating faster or going faster. And then I can say, oh, I'm feeling a little bit stressed. What is it that's bothering me right now? And I can start identifying it earlier and maybe not have as big of a reaction. And that's the same thing we're hoping with our students. But again, I think as a school district, we're really working on social emotional learning as being very important and something that we need to work through. This class lets us kind of do it in a way that it's not just 1 hour a day or like an isolated subject. It's something that we work through in every hour and in kind of all the different facets of the school. So then that way it becomes embedded in something they use better and that we are able to use better as well.
When you talk about when will I ever use this, this is a hard thing. But, you know, I hate algebra. I hated algebra, but I do use it. It is hard to tell them that you'll need it.
Mm-hmm.
You may not need it every day, but you're definitely going to need it because a lot of them have already got set what they're going to do. I was just talking recently with a girl who wants to be a tattoo artist, but mm-hmm. she says she's also going to college and get a business degree because she's going to have to run her business.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just pretty drawing on somebody's skin. She's going to have to figure out how to get her license, how to run her business, how to keep her books. So when you're teaching these kids that are having, they're struggling to graduate anyway. So you're trying to get them a clear path forward that, you know, learning, frankly, doesn't just stop after you graduate. It's
right.
going to continue all the way along. Is that because a lot of kids don't like going to school? Mm-hmm. They don't like learning, if you call it that, but they do like exploring and doing new things. So how do you get them, Marcy, excited about learning and, you know, because that's going to be something they're going to have to do the rest of their life.
Yes. Well, Mary, once students understand more about why they respond or what they need in their environment, it clears the path. It removes barriers. And so then you can get down to the learning. So, you know, we always say that all behavior and reactions or lack of reactions, we have a lot of kids are very internally they're introverted, and so you don't always know what they're thinking because they don't have those outwardly responses. And so the better that we can have people understand and create an environment that is conducive for that, then we can get down to learning, help students achieve their credits. A lot of times what we notice is, too, once we remove those barriers, then some of that absence and that confidence of, okay, I can make an effort to try to do, like you were just talking about, the hard math problems, algebra, mm-hmm. geometry, business, whatever their they're excited about or something that's a new obstacle for them. It's very difficult to get to any of that if a student is coming into an environment or an adult for that matter, because adults deal with heavy things every day as well.
And most of us don't have the kind of training you're giving these young people.
Right.
So actually, they may be better prepared to take on the world than someone who has always been a high-achieving student and, you know, good attendance, good grades, mm-hmm. but they may have a lot of anxiety and they just
exactly.
internalize it.
And we are noticing more and more anxiety in students now because there's so many opportunities to do things like Erica alluded to earlier. There is online learning. There's other ways now to do education. COVID taught us that. We can still learn and do things in different types of settings. And so what we're missing is more of that human interaction. And so there is a lot of anxiety. There's sometimes students that come to our smaller school have a hard time going back to their home school because it is, for example, like at Quincy Senior High, it's a large building. And so that can be very overwhelming. And so knowing more about how your response and how your body responds to those things so that you can be set up for success, because it, like you stated, it doesn't mean that you can't learn. It doesn't mean that you're not highly intelligent. It just means some other things interfere with you being able to demonstrate your strengths or the talents that you have in offering. And so the science isn't new. You know, this isn't
right,
new
this
information.
Isn't new. Yeah, everybody's
it's a
med school
it's a different
this.
Way
yeah.
of looking at it. And the great thing about us taking this on this school year was the fact that our staff and students get to learn it together and learn co-regulation so that we can learn more about ourselves too, because then our responses to students' behavior or lack of motivation or whatever, you know, they bring to the table, that we're not dealing with it from our point of view, but we're seeing more of, oh, this is what I need to do to be this, to be helpful for a student today. So.
Because you get frustrated too.
Absolutely.
And you have anxieties at home and you have things that are hanging over your head that you can't, you know, you have to separate that. You can't come into school and say, well, I'm only going to be at 50% today because of something that, you know, because my parents are sick or, you know, I've got a sick kid or, you know, I'm worried about my job review or whatever. Everybody has a burden they're bearing. Your children that you teach too, they have kind of another strike against them, which is why it's so great the academy can kind of even the playing field. A lot of them don't have that support at home. They probably, when they graduate from the academy, have better regulation of their emotions than some of their parents.
It's interesting that you say that, because we all continue to learn. You know, you always talk about it takes a village. Well, we learn when we meet with families, and you can see the dynamics. I know how I was raised. I was raised by a very strict authoritarian personality, and so then I know that I took that on, but then I also know I overcompensate from that, like when I raised my own son. And so it's really interesting how, you know, as adults, we try to we always try to give our best to our kiddos, but we make mistakes all the time as well. And so it's just that match of personalities. My son is very different than me. And so I can't speak to him the way I like to be spoke to. You know, I can't do
kind of
the
like
same.
The love language thing.
Exactly.
You know, he's not going to respond.
Exactly.
His reward system is different than yours.
Exactly.
And really when it comes down to it, I mean, it really is. It's from the time they're little, we potty train them, and then we train them to sit and use a utensil and not eat with their fingers. I mean, it's all just, we're constantly conforming to a societal, you know, boundaries that are norms of accepted behavior. But things happen outside the norm of accepted behavior, and there's often not a playbook to do that. So is that where... Talk about your relationship with these children, because I'm interested in this, Erica, because like when they're online, they're working online, but you're there to keep motivating them, to keep saying, yeah, you know, you've got an hour kind of to do this project. You can kind of time it however you want, but in an hour, this is expected to be done, because when they go to a work job, in an hour, it's going to be expected to be done.
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, possibly a misconception about the academy or something that I've learned since working there. I work with wonderful kids, and it's been great to make a relationship with them and a connection with them, and they genuinely want to achieve. Like, that is something that I've never met anybody who wants to fail at life, and all of these students, same thing. They all want to achieve, and they just sometimes need a cheerleader, a champion. champion, you know, somebody to support them. Also, we want our students to, like we talked about with neuroscience, we want them to recognize their emotions and everything, but we also want them to become confident young people as well. And so helping hear them when they tell you something, you know, like whether they're feeling dysregulated or tired or frustrated, hearing them, honoring that and working through it, I think also really helps build that relationship. We also do something called Connect Time at the start of every hour, where we just sit and have a genuine conversation for about the first 10 minutes of every class time. It's a great time to learn little things about them, get a read on how they're feeling that day, and then also just kind of move together cohesively, like we work together from that point. So
it's much more team oriented. I understand. I mean, I remember sitting in a class, you know, between 25 and 40 kids when I was in elementary school. Now, high school is a little bit different, but you know, you had to kind of conform to the group. I mean, you couldn't just get up and just wander around, or you know, I mean, you know, and so getting to understand they're kind of working as a team because they're all trying to succeed together.
And yeah, absolutely.
Having people that know you and support you and be with your peers, because everybody finds their peer group. And this the academy, who gets placed there? I mean, do parents request it? Does the school district make you go there? How do you get into the academy? The academy sounds so elite. It's like I went to Harvard.
It's a good
I'm a
place.
Graduate of the academy. I mean, how do you get into the academy?
I'm glad you're as proud as we are. We love our school. So actually,
I'm going to misbehave deliberately so I can get into the academy.
It's funny you mentioned that. That's not usually why they are referred, but it's often hard to get them to go back to their home school because they do have so much support. So, yes, Mary, students are referred to the academy, supposed to be by their superintendent or their principal, through a process that is through our regional safe school process. But basically, students have to be suspension or expulsion eligible. So that could be a number of infractions or a very, very serious infraction. And so once that happens, there is an internal process where our internal team reviews their data and information to make sure that it's a placement that we can facilitate and help the child succeed. The purpose is for it to be an intervention. It's not supposed to be a place where you come and you live and, you know, you stay forever. The goal is to always go back to your home school, just depending on when you come to us and the amount of time we have. And also, like you touched on earlier, attendance is huge. If you don't show up, you can't go up. And so you have to show up in order to receive assistance and help and learn these things. And habits are hard to break, so it takes a lot of time and consistency. And like Erica touched on too, you have to have that trust. So it's all about the connection at first, and then clear boundaries, clear rules, consistency, universal language, universal expectations. And every student has an individual plan. They all have an alternative education plan, and we look at every student and what their need is, and we try to really help them. We don't make excuses, and we don't give up, so we keep pushing forward, but there's just a lot of factors that go into a student's success, and so it takes the whole team, it takes everybody every day, it takes the families and our community resources as well. So we're very, very lucky to have so many people who have invested in our students and our program and help make it successful. But like Erica said, we have amazing kiddos, and they have so many talents. A lot of times they just don't know what they are. They haven't experienced those yet. So it's really fun to watch kids start believing in themselves, realizing that they can walk across the stage, realizing they get to be an individual. They don't have to fit the mold. And they can be loved for who they are. And it's amazing to watch so many different personalities and backgrounds come together. And we have a lot of families who don't necessarily get along outside of school, but it's very unique to watch them be able to, I guess, tolerate and accept each other and their differences by that connect time and getting to know each other. Because once we can learn how to empathize, not sympathize, but once students learn the true value of empathy and understanding where someone's coming from and the why they do do the things they do or respond the way they respond, sometimes they realize they have more in common than they you know, once thought they were so different.
Romeo and Juliet would be a great thing to talk about. Well, we have to take a break, and we're out of time for today. We've got another guest coming in. But you guys, I really applaud you for what you do, because cookie-cutter kids are not really what the public school system or any school system is supposed to be creating. That's pretty easy, though, to say you're all going to be stamped, and we're going to test you, and you're going to, you know, reach this level, and then, you know, you go forward to the next to put icing on or whatever. But you guys are really taking people as individuals, which we don't often think of children sometimes as individuals. We do want to try to get them to conform, get in the box, do what you're supposed to do. And yet, when they, 5 years after graduation, we don't expect that of them. In fact, we do something different, explore, expand. So you're kind of, you've got the right idea. So congratulations, and you've got good success, or it wouldn't still be happening, because there's a lot of money that goes into this. This is one of the most expensive programs that the public schools offer. So thank you for being so patient. You know, nobody ever told me to go regulate myself. I'm learning all kinds of new vocabulary. Well, I have to regulate myself to take a break, or I'm going to get fired. See, I'm learning how to.
There we go.
See, I can't have you people on with Inside Out and just sit about, talk about my emotions all day. I've got to head up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative and see what's happening up there today. Rex Battery brings you this report. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. Steve Halpin joins me, a native of Quincy, but now lives in Hannibal, and is... Yeah, okay, let's start there. We're going to talk about the Coin Club, but how the heck did you get to Hannibal?
When I finished medical school in Springfield, Illinois, I was looking for a job in the Hannibal-Quincy area, and both recruited me, and Hannibal's job was a little bit better at the time.
Wow. So you could have been in Quincy all these years, but Hannibal came calling with a better offer.
That's exactly.
And you've never looked back.
No.
Talk to me a little bit about, you couldn't go to medical school in Springfield.
Yes.
Could you? There's a medical school in Springfield. Well, SIU.
Yes, exactly.
See, I'm sitting there thinking of University of Illinois Champaign, and we don't, our medical school's in Champaign or Chicago, but you went to
Southern Illinois University.
Southern Illinois, and you came up and did your...
I had 1 year in Carbondale and the rest in Springfield.
Okay, so now we know that. Well, despite the fact that he's a doctor, we're not going to talk about any doctor things today. We're going to talk about coin collecting and stamp collecting and the 16th annual Mark Twain Area Coin and Stamp Show, which is this Saturday from 9 to 4, free of charge in Hannibal this year, at the Hannibal American Legion Post, 3819 Highway MM. So basically get to the Hardee's Junction there in Hannibal and just turn westbound and you can't miss the American Legion. We've talked last week a little bit about, you know, people will be there buying coins, selling coins, trading. There'll be some swapping going on. You've got stamps, you've got antiquities, you've got all kinds of different things that are going to be there. For the curiosity seeker, if somebody doesn't know much about coin collecting, this would be kind of a wonderful little walkthrough where you're going to get to meet a lot of people who are perfectly willing to answer your stupid question like, why is that coin important or why is that so rare? Because really, a lot of people have a lot of questions about this stuff.
It'll be like a museum almost. We'll have 27 different dealers with 40 8-foot tables, and they'll have their wares out for you to look at and to touch and hold, and you know, you'll be able to touch coins that you've probably never seen, 2-cent pieces, 3-cent pieces, half cents, half dimes, a lot of silver dollars, a lot of silver eagles. We'll have stock certificates. And this year we also have a person who's a stamp collector and a coin collector, but also is going to have some Civil War autograph and Civil War memorabilia.
Well, that'll draw some interesting people in, too, because it's a big, the Tri-State Civil War Roundtable is big here, and there'll be a lot of people who want to come down just to talk about those items.
They may want to purchase something with Abraham or Lincoln's signature or Ulysses S. Grant or who knows what.
Who knows what? How in the world, when you get involved in this, because you did it as a child, you did it as a young man, and then you were busy, and then you got back involved in it a few years ago. How did you get back involved, and what was it that drew you back, Steve Halpin?
I had a good friend of mine that I did a lot of traveling with, Buzz Ballinger, who talked me into joining him at the Coin Club, because I knew he knew that I had an interest, and I just fell in love with it again.
Did you have the coins you had when you were a kid, or had that all gone by the wayside?
Fortunately, I still had them. My mother had not discarded them or sold them.
So in other words, you just like most of us, our parents store these valuable collections, and then later on, when they finally either get ready to downsize or they pass, it's like, get this stuff out of my house.
Exactly.
I'm not going to keep it anymore. So you kind of started looking at it again. You had this friend. You had the natural connection. It's all different kinds of people collect coins. What would you say is the biggest draw to it? Is it the adventure of finding something really rare? Is it a monetary thrill when you get something that's worth a lot of money? Of course, those two things can kind of be the same. Or is it just something that maybe is just unusual but not necessarily has much value, but just odd? Like, I'd never heard of a half dime. I mean, what the heck was that before the nickel? I mean, what the heck is a half dime?
Yes, it was before the nickel, certainly.
So they called it a half dime. They couldn't think of their own name for it. You've got one. Okay, let me see this thing. He's going to hand it to me. Now, you say I can touch it, but I really can't touch it because this is an 1858 seated half dime. Is that Lady Liberty sitting down there?
Exactly.
Okay. And I really can't touch it because it's in this wonderful container.
Two by two cardboard.
To keep it, from me touching it. Now, this seems to have some dirt and patina on it. So you say don't ever clean them, though, right?
No, don't clean them. No, it's not dirt. Silver does oxidize and change colors and tone, as we say. But no, never clean a coin.
So when did they decide that the half dime was a silly name? Because I'm deciding it's a silly name, Steve Halpin. When did they say we've got to come up with something better than that?
It was in the 1800s, right after the Civil War. I think 1873 or something, they quit making the half dimes.
Okay. So they quit making half times and they went to something that was called a nickel.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when we look back at money, I think a lot of people think money's kind of always been the same. But money hasn't always been the same. Coins used to have a big hole in it so you could wear it around your neck. I mean, it's amazing and fascinating, the history of coinage. And how much of that, when we come on Saturday, April 12th, if we have a specific question about something like this half dime, which I've never even heard of. Now, I find it odd that at my age, I'd never even heard of a half dime. But, of course, I'm not in the
numismatics.
Numismatics. I'm not into numismatics. So do you find that there's like just this whole bunch of people that are really super smart, but they're definitely very interested in this one thing, so they have this extreme depth of knowledge in this one field?
We have experts in all different areas, and you would think everybody that collects coins would know everything there is to know about coins, but we'll have people there that specialize in seated coins, and we have a gentleman coming from Decatur that specializes in barber coins, and so there's special.
What are barber coins?
They're the designer of the coin. That's
The man's name was Barber.
Man's name was the designer of the coin. Liberty head on the coin, and so there's be specialty numismatics that will be able to answer all of your questions that
okay.
you have.
Coins are art too. I mean, they're beautiful. Back in the olden days, they really cared about what coins looked like. They took great care in getting the mint proof or whatever it was. Do you find that there's not as much artistry today?
Well, there still is. There's the U.S. Mint still sells sets of coins that are absolutely beautiful, proof coins, and so they're still making beautiful coins today.
But those aren't the kind we circulate and spend.
No.
Okay. So there definitely is the difference between me emptying out my pocket of change and coming to a coin show and seeing the kind of stuff that is there, because a lot of those coins will be in what they call mint condition. That's where we got the term from, I guess.
Correct.
Mint condition. They have not been circulated. They were bought by collectors the minute they came off the press, and they have been preserved in that beauty just as a work of art.
Yeah, there's a lot of history in coins when you hold a coin in your hand that's from the 1700s and realize that this was in circulation when George Washington was president.
Paper money. Is paper money part of what you collect too?
Yes, not personally what I collect, but there will be a lot of currency dealers there. And currency is the same way. There's a lot of older currency that is in mint condition that have been well maintained and are quite valuable.
Now, we just have the new king in England, and so now they're printing English money now with his picture on it instead of his mother's. And so eventually, at the moment, his coin is rare because they haven't printed a lot of them. Eventually, her coin will be rare, I guess, because something will happen. It'll slide down the gutter or whatever.
Well, Queen Elizabeth was around for a lot of years, so there's a lot of coins with her picture on it. But King Charles will have a short mintage because he's ill, and his son William will soon be taking over, I understand. So his coins may well be one of the things that's highly prized 50 years from now.
So is that something that people will go out and get? I mean, would I just dish that out? Like if I wanted to be a casual collector, would I just, like the first time I saw one of those passed to me at the grocery store, I would just take that, take it home and put it in my little cardboard thing and make a note of it and hope that someday it'll be worth some money? Or does it have to come from the mint for it to really be valuable?
No, it doesn't have to come from the mint to be valuable. A lot of these coins that we all have are coins that we dug out of circulation when we were children.
Yeah.
Back when silver was still carried around in everybody's pockets, and when they stopped putting silver in coins in 1964, then those coins that had the silver in them then became much more valuable instantaneously.
Sometimes I think that the U.S. Mint deliberately does things just to get people to collect them. In other words, this quarter will never be spent. And I think about right now in the second grade where I'm volunteering, the kids are collecting the quarter sets from the States. And something like that, they printed so many of them. But a lot of those now are in a book somewhere where you could collect all 50 states, and there may have been some territories that had a coin. I don't know.
There were.
Yeah. So is that something like you as a coin collector, when that comes out, do you make sure you get that, or is that just something that you say, everybody's going to have that?
They will probably never be valuable, probably never be worth more than a quarter, but it still is nice for kids and adults to put a set together and look and appreciate the states that we have and the history and find out when the states became states, and there's a lot of history that can be learned from the coins themselves. But as far as those quarter sets, they'll probably only be worth a quarter per coin for the rest of my
for the rest of your life at least.
Right.
And that again is I sometimes think these collectible stamps and these collectible coins now that are being minted now, they're just a way to get people to buy them without ever having to actually circulate them in our economy. I wonder if it's not just a ploy. This forever stamp thing, has that changed stamp collecting? The forever stamp.
Yes, I think it probably will. But there's a lot of stamps made that are absolutely beautiful today that are collected. But the stamp collectors, like coin collectors, like those ones that are rare and unique and hard to find, that's what makes them valuable.
Now, Henry Sweets, I think, collects naval cancellations on stamps. I just remember that because one time we were somewhere and he wanted to look at a stamp thing. Is a stamp more valuable if it's canceled, or does it matter where it's or how it's canceled? Does that make it valuable?
There is some difference on the cancellations and how dirty it looks and that type of a thing, and I'm not a stamp collector myself.
Right.
We are going to have six stamp collectors at our show, and they will come from Kansas City and Decatur and St. Louis and all around, so we encourage anybody who's interested in stamps to come. I don't know that much personally about stamps myself.
But you'll be able to find out. And if you have stamps,
there will be people there that do know a lot about stamps.
There'll be people there that know a lot about stamps. There are going to be over 35 dealers there. They've got these big, long tables. They're going to have lots and lots of merchandise. It is Saturday, April 12th from 9 to 4. It's absolutely free of charge, by the way. There's no admission to get into the building. The parking is also free. Dealers coming from all over the Midwest and even farther flung than that. The Hannibal Coin Club and the Quincy Coin Club also do some charitable work. When you have this show, you don't charge admission. So I know every month you have little auctions among yourselves. Talk about some of your charitable work, because believe it or not, you guys give away money, modern day money.
We give all the profits that we make are eventually donated to charity. The dealers pay to have a table at the show, and that's where we garner most of our money. We also have coin clubs that meet every month, both in Hannibal and Quincy. Membership's only $10. That also helps to go toward our charity. We have elephant auctions that we have once a year where people bring in their treasures from home, and we auction them off and give them to each other, and that money all goes to charity. Last year alone, the Hannibal Coin Club itself gave away $1,000 to five different local charities, $200 each.
That's great.
And so I think we do some good work, and we have fun and good camaraderie at the same time.
Okay. Now, if I go down there and I'm not a coin collector, what are my chances I'm going to walk away with something like this half dime that I'm like, that's just cool. I want it. I may not ever collect another coin, but that is cool and I want it. What are my chances that you're going to lure people in and they're going to, like, first time, they'll go, I got to have it.
We're going to have a door prize for the first 200 people that sign up and as they register. You don't have to pay to get in, and you don't have to sign anything to get in. But if you want to be eligible for one of our door prizes, then you will sign in. And everybody who does sign in, the first 200, will get a free door prize, a free coin.
Okay. Wow.
Can't beat that.
You cannot beat that. Now, I've seen a lot of people take coins and turn them into, like, necklaces, jewelry, earrings. Is that kind of, like, makes you scream, don't do it? Or is it, I mean, they're beautiful works of art.
Yes, I think we talked a little bit last week about melting coins. And you can make jewelry out of coins, and you can make melt coins and change coins if you're going to do it for jewelry purposes or not-for-profit reasons. You can't melt coins and then try to turn around and sell the metal that you get out of it. But, yeah, there's a lot of beautiful jewelry that's coins. And, of course, coin collectors cringe when they look at the coin that's in an earring and find out if it hadn't been in that earring, it would have been worth $10,000. But, you know, to each their own. I mean,
do you walk up to them and say that?
No.
Hey, lady, I like your earrings. Oh, thank you. I love them, too. You know, if you hadn't made them into earrings, you could have paid for your kids' college education, you know. When people collect these coins, what do you think somebody who's really big, like one of these dealers that's going to come from Kansas City, have they got millions of dollars in assets sitting there in coins, or is that too far-fetched?
It's probably too far-fetched. We are going to have security at the site,
yeah,
but we aren't going to have millions there.
There's
but
no admission, but please don't take any money away if you haven't paid for it.
We have a sheriff's department there, and we have plenty of security available, but there won't be millions of dollars laying around, but there'll be tens of thousands of dollars laying around that people can look at, hold, and admire.
My only chance to probably hold on to tens of thousands of dollars. Who am I kidding? Well, Steve Halpin, it's been absolutely delightful. We have known each other since childhood. Golly gee. We joke our dads worked together for years, and neither of us chose that. Well, I kind of chose that as my career. You went a different way, being a doctor. And the great thing about this is a fun pastime. You can get as serious about it as you want, or you can be as casual about it as you want. But the most important thing is to come down to Hannibal and see, because this half dime just fascinates me. I just want to pick it up and look at it, and you know, you do want to touch them. So definitely there's something to be said for going to the coin show. It is Saturday from 9 to 4 in Hannibal, free of charge at the American Legion Hall, and there'll be door prizes, so please show up.